Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Eric.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I am hanging in there. Thank you. Jeff, people have been asking us for our take on the Cam versus Mace beef.
Is it a beef?
We have zero takes.
Zero takes because it's not really a beef if Cam says it's not a beef.
We have nothing to say about that. What we do want to talk about, though, is the Diplomats reunion show that went down... a few days before Thanksgiving.
Right. Spotify was putting together their Rap Caviar New York show with ASAP Mob and Don Q and...
A reunited Diplomats.
Yeah.
So you're going to get Jim, you're going to get Cam, you're going to get Freaky, and you're going to get Juelz. All on one stage. Everyone was really looking forward to it, especially these two guys.
Yeah, because they were actually posting about each other and they were... doing stuff that made it seem like it was a reunion. And
we were very excited. We were put on the list. We went down there 2 hours late, but that's fine. Like, you know, this is Dipset time, right?
Yeah.
We showed up.
And it was 2008?
It was about 2008 cops outside. Like,
yeah.
All of the New York Police Department was there with these barricades, pushing people into the streets, getting them away from Hammerstein Ballroom, and trying to... I guess organize when it just seemed like it was just chaos from the beginning.
Yeah, because they tell you to get off the sidewalk, and then they push you into the street, and then they tell you to get out of the street and onto the sidewalk.
It was just a lot. So we jump into this long line, and we are here to get into this concert.
Right, and it's not like we're going to jump to the front of the line and say, do you know who we are? We have a niche podcast. We get into these deep dives, you know, conversations, going through a person's long history from point A to point B.
None of that. We didn't give them the elevator pitch. We just got online, and the moment we got in there, they shut the thing down. And we're getting texts inside saying that people are about to go on, that ASAP Rocky is out there talking, and we're like, well, this is not good. And we turn to our right, and who do we see?
We see everybody from Rock Nation.
Yeah, but they can't get in, and that is when we decided this was not going to happen.
Or what we really thought was we're going to go join them. Because if anybody's going to get into this concert,
if anybody understands this niche podcast, it's all these people who have been on it already.
Right.
Let's get in together. They said, we can't even get in. We got Jim in. That's as much as we can do. Lenny S. was like, I'm going to go see a movie.
Well, he didn't just say any movie. He said, I'm going to go see Bad Moms Christmas 2.
Why?
Because Bad Moms Christmas 1 was really good.
There you go. So we said, enjoy, have fun. We stayed out there. They all left. And we stuck around
long enough to see that Cam wasn't let in.
And then just keeps walking. And we're like, well, you know.
Fuck it.
Yeah. So we head towards the train station because we are going to go home, get some dinner, and... probably, you know, read about how this concert never happened because Cam couldn't get in.
And we were smart to leave at like 10 o'clock. That's what we were going to read about.
We went one block.
And then we see fucking Cam and 40 people trailing behind him walking down 8th Avenue south past where the venue is.
Right.
Past the post office.
Like, did not stop.
No, it was like seeing Muhammad Ali down in Africa. Just like this massive crowd of people, phones out, and British yelling. British is Cam's manager.
Right.
British was yelling at certain people.
And
like,
you know what? We were like, this is amazing. We have to join in.
Yeah, so now we are part of this
thing. We're part of this school of fish, and we work our way towards Cam before Cam like makes a right and heads towards some parking lot. And we're like, well... at this point, we can either just stay here and not say hi to a bunch of our friends in this crowd, or we can follow. And so we followed, and we went towards him until he was having a very heated conversation with some other people at the parking garage, and we decided...
you want to know what? We've gone too far.
Yeah, we've seen enough.
Now we are stalkers.
That's right. But, you know what? At that point, with Cam not even getting in, with... the cops shutting the line down outside with so many people just standing there and telling random people who are walking by that it's a concert because people are like, what is this? That Rock Nation couldn't get in. That whole thing. Isn't that the most Diplomat type of evening?
Yes. Also, it should be said, we thought we were so smart.
Oh my God.
We were like, smart. We are going to go home. We are not going to stay outside of this venue that we can't get inside.
It's windy out. We're not going to be stupid and catch a cold out here.
Nope. Go home, and then it turns out that the concert went on.
Yeah, at like 11:30. So we're dumb. I hate that we didn't go there. I'm mad that we didn't stick it out and try to bum rush the door. But, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
Shout out to the diplomats.
Shout out to the diplomats. And also, I think Mace won round one. All right. So, on this week's podcast, we have the comedian, the very funny Ron Funches, who has an incredible story.
And you guys know his work from Kroll Show. You know him from doing live stand-up with John Mulaney. He was on Curb Your Enthusiasm recently.
He does voice work for Bob's Burgers and a whole bunch of other cartoons.
You've seen him on Conan. He's an amazingly funny guy. He grew up in Chicago, moved out to Salem, Oregon. Talks about starting a career in entertainment in the middle of nowhere in the Northwest and actually being found and then making a national career and moving down to Los Angeles to become the Ron Funches we all know.
And the one who gets to go to parties with Sarah Silverman and, you know, dip his hands into barrels full of joints.
You know, like, it is... He lives the dream.
Yeah, it is a really, really good podcast. We were so happy to have him on while he was in town.
A few things before we get into the podcast. Just want to mention that if you guys are looking to support this podcast and want to do that in conjunction with getting a Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, wintertime present, go to itsthereal.com/shop and get an It's The Real t-shirt right now. Also, shout out to everybody who has been reviewing and rating our podcast on iTunes. We see you and we appreciate you, and we know that we bug you all the time to do it, so thank you for following through. Jeff, when do you want to get into this?
Right now.
Yo, what up? It's Eric, a.k.a. From the Gutter, a.k.a. Stephen King's It.
Yo, what up? It's Jeff, a.k.a. Getting Face, a.k.a. Are You Stark.
Yo, what's up, y'all? It's Ron, a.k.a. Chocolate Covered Gummy Bear, a.k.a. Late Rent Payment.
Yeah, and this is a waste of time, but this is the real. Ron, what's happening?
Not much. How are you guys doing?
We're good. Thank you so much for coming through.
Thank you for having me.
How long are you in the city for?
I'm just here through Sunday, just doing shows at Caroline's.
Right.
I'm doing like pre-show for the Night of Too Many Stars, because they really got too many stars. They got too many that I'm on the pre-show.
So what does that even mean? Are you...
I'm like just like doing crowd work while people find their seats,
right?
Basically.
Yeah, yeah. Anybody here from out of town?
I know. All that, yeah. Who here has autism?
Where are you originally from?
I'm originally from Los Angeles.
Right.
I was born in Los Angeles in Gardena. But I was raised in Chicago from like ages 4 till 13, and then lived in Oregon. That's where I started comedy.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So how many brothers and sisters do you have?
I have one full sister.
Okay.
And I have several half siblings that I don't really count.
Okay. You only half count them. Did you like Chicago while you were there?
Not when I was a kid. I like it now.
Yeah.
Like when I go back, I'm like, oh, it's a beautiful city. But when I was a kid, I was like, this is terrifying.
Really?
People just throw pennies at me.
Yeah.
So I was like, I just was scared mostly.
And so when it came time to move to Salem, Oregon, mm-hmm. were you like, great?
I was just like, yeah, I want to get out of here. I'm not doing real well. And I grew up in like Catholic school most of my life. And then
were you Catholic?
by default. Yeah, yeah. At the time. and then my mom like couldn't afford it anymore. She's a single mom, you know, raising two kids. And so we had to go to public school. And I don't know if you guys know, but Chicago public schools are not the best.
Not the best.
Well, what was your team name?
I don't even know. The metal detectors, probably.
I saw you talk somewhere about how, you know, you were listening to Alanis Morissette. You just didn't fit in with everybody around you.
Yeah, I mean, I've just always been, you know, a shyer person, a little more low-key person, and that didn't really fit in there. It was always about being hype and, you know, just being tougher in particular.
Wait, and tough about God? Like in Catholic school? Like, how does that...
It was a weird school. It was a Catholic school where people got expelled for smoking weed in the coat rooms and stuff like that. It was like, you know, it was a Catholic school in name, but, you know, it definitely wasn't as rough as that public school.
Right,
That was freaking terrifying, because it was just a bunch of, like, tough kids who all knew each other from first grade until then, and then I just showed up. So
what part of Chicago were you living in?
In Southside, 69th and Woodlawn, to be exact. Near Stony Island.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And your older sister, what was her experience in Chicago?
She was similar, you mm-hmm. know, but we kind of went two separate paths. She was very studious, very like she's going to get out of it through her studies, and she became a doctor like by her mid-20s. She was already through medical school. Man. So and I was just like, I'm going to take bong hits
in the coat closet and you know, hopefully not get expelled. Yeah. When you do go to Oregon, mm-hmm. are you happy immediately?
No, not really, because my dad had like this shitty girlfriend that he was with, and
do you want to shout her out?
Shout out to Rosalyn, rest in peace. She is no longer.
let's really see the reach of this podcast. So you get up to Salem, Oregon. What do you know about Oregon?
Not much at the time. I don't think I know anything about Oregon at the time, and not even know how to pronounce it at the time.
Yo, they get pissed if you say like Oregon.
Yeah,
right?
They do. Yeah. They do, and I think that's what I was saying at that point. And so I just was like, oh, it's probably full of like just cowboys and country music, and for the most part, I was right.
Yeah, there you go.
Congratulations.
So you go up there, but 13, that's like, that's a tough age to move.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was the formative age, I guess. But in a lot of ways, it really helped me out, because it let me see that, just get a different perspective on things, because like the things that were cool in Chicago weren't cool in Oregon, and things that were cool in Oregon would have got me beating the shit up out of me. So
like what?
Just, you know, again, a lot of country music. Grease was huge.
The country?
Yeah, both. Yeah. Nice couple jokes.
Yeah. This is like a writer's room. We're just like punching up, you know, at all times.
Yeah, they were all about that spanakopita and baklava and stuff. So it was different.
Was that something where you could just like start anew and like, you know, create whoever you were?
No, mostly I just kept to myself, really. Like, I just was like the kid sitting by his locker just reading Molière or reading some other bullshit. And
at 13, 14?
Yeah, man.
You were so interesting. I know. Yeah. Like, what an interesting person you are.
Alanis Morissette, Morière. Did you have a cowboy hat on?
No, fit in. Cowboy hat. But I got my ears pierced because I thought that, I remember the girls, this was still in Chicago, but the girls had like a list of like what you could do to be more attractive. And they were like, Ron should get his ears pierced. And so I did, and they were wrong.
Yo, did you have like studs, or were they like the heavy like diamonds like Cam had? Like,
oh, I wish. I had studs, and I should have known it was a bad decision, because my dad was like, I'll do it too.
Wow.
Yeah, this clearly isn't cool anymore.
So high school in Oregon, do you have a job when you get up there?
No. I mean, I'm just kind of just going to school, and that was it for a few years. And then, you know, my dad moved away. A lot of people moved away, and I was still there, and I had a girlfriend. And by the time I was 20, I had my son. So I was kind of just entrenched in being there for a while.
Wow. By the time you ended high school, you were just like, my life is going to be in Salem, Oregon forever?
I mean, I didn't want that, but it was looking like that. And mostly I was just like, I didn't know what I was going to do. I mean, I always, you know, since I was like 4 or 5, it's like comedy is all I've really been interested in, but I just didn't think it was a real job, you know. Yeah. I thought it was just like make believe or something.
You
like,
really were a parent.
So what was your first job out there?
My first real job, I worked at a Chuck E. Cheese.
Okay.
For 3 weeks. And then they fired me because they said I wasn't personable.
The whole restaurant is like animatronics.
Yeah, and I was in the back cooking pizza, so I didn't really
understand. How personable do you have to be?
I didn't get it. I think it was just I was bad at it. I was not good at it. Yeah. I will agree with that.
And eventually you moved on to doing what out there?
Then I bounced around. I worked at a cannery for a while. I worked at a couple grocery stores as the world's most popular cashier.
Okay.
Congratulations.
Yep. Yes.
Wow, it was great. People really enjoyed me.
Did any of the Chuck E. Cheese people walk in and they're just like, you know what? I was wrong about you.
Yeah. you were very personable.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I really turned it around.
Yeah.
I really turned it around. And then I worked at a bank for a while, at a bank call center. Just any job. All my jobs, the only way I could survive, because I was not I did not have much of a work ethic. Was I was just good at talking. I was good at talking my way out of things, or anytime I got in trouble. I remember, because I would take like hour and a half lunches, and then I would just not show up for work.
Yeah, what's the
times.
Rush, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's what I feel. And then they eventually, my boss would find out, and they'd be like, "What's the deal? Like, what's the deal with the missed lunch?" And I just like, "Look, I don't remember. That was 2 weeks ago." I was like, "The past is the past, man. We got to focus on the future."
Right. So are you doing anything in high school to sort of like further your ambitions of comedy at any like rate?
No, I mean, the only thing when I look back at it, I did a couple sketches with some friends and stuff like that. We would do some backyard wrestling, things like that. So we were always kind of like videotaping things every now and then, but nothing with this clear like, oh, I want to be a comedian or anything like that. I didn't come until like I had my son, and then once he was diagnosed with autism, I was like, oh, I need a career.
Right.
And I was like, this was the only thing I'm interested in pursuing, like a career. So I got started hitting open mics.
Well, first of all, like, how did you, when your son was diagnosed, like, how did you find out, how did you come to that decision to take him to the hospital, like all that?
Well, you know, he just was an aloof kid. I just thought he was a cool kid. You know, he didn't need a lot of you to look at him a lot. He was just doing his own thing. And I just thought that's who he was. And then my mom. She was just like, you know, she just saw certain things that was like, you know, matched up with symptoms of autism, and she was just like, you might want to think about taking him in. And I bristled up, and I was just like, no, he's just, you know, he's just a weird kid. He's just like his dad. We're just weirdos, you know?
Yeah.
And, but, you know, because for a while we thought he was deaf, because he wouldn't respond to things when you, like, you could, like, drop a book right next to him, and he would just zone right into whatever he was watching. So there's just things like that. Because at first, you know, he was developing pretty normally for like the first 2 years, and then it seemed like it just regressed. He stopped talking and started staring and stopped sleeping. So
that's a lot for someone who's in their very early 20s too, wouldn't
you
say?
Yeah.
I mean, on top of being a parent in your early 20s, like, were you just forced to grow up like immediately?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of always had been. Like, you know, I grew up, my mom was in like an abusive relationship, and she was a single mom, so I've always kind of like defaulted to being like the man of the house. So I'm mostly doing my childhood now. Buying a lot of action figures, going to the gym all the time.
Are you still doing backyard wrestling?
Yeah, actually, I'm starting wrestling school in January. So
no way.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you ready for that?
Yes.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if this is like a marathon where you have to like, you know, build up and train or.
Oh, I mean, I've been training. You know, I lost like 130 pounds.
True. So congratulations.
I'm just trying to take it to that next level. See how fit I can be.
Well, but yeah, but you need like a character.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Oh, so what is your, yeah,
right now, I mean, I don't know, things change as they develop, but I feel like I've always wanted to be Ron Reckless Negro Funches. You know, and then my catchphrase is, hide your weed and white women, there's a reckless Negro coming. And I wear like cut off jean shorts. I'm from the coast of Oregon.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I'm just reckless and wild mostly. I feel like that. I mean, I have thought about it a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit.
When you applied for wrestling school, did you have to write all this down in like one
section? No, you just gotta give them a check.
When you were doing backyard wrestling, though, like in high school, what was the like craziest thing that you guys would do?
We would do a lot of. My dad had this like broken down old BMW in the front, and we would just jump on it and jump off of it, and had my friend give me a leg drop from the top of it to the hood of the car. She left these big old dents in it that we would just be like, we don't know.
Have you spoken to Anise about this?
I have not about. I mean, I've talked to Anise about wrestling a lot.
Well, sure, that's what Anise likes to talk about.
Yeah. But no, I haven't talked to him since I decided I was going to class. But I'm sure I'll see him at like PWG or something.
Yeah.
So you're in your early 20s. You're still in. Are you still in Salem, or have you moved to like Portland? Or
I'm in my early 20s. I'm still in Salem.
Okay.
Yeah.
And like, what is Salem like in your early 20s as a father? Like, what can
you? It's depressing.
Yeah,
it's very depressing. It's a lot of apathy. It's a lot of like, we'll never get out of this town. Or
It's everyone agrees.
Everyone agrees. Yeah, everyone agrees. Like, you're just looking for a job at a call center, whether it's a bank or T-Mobile or something of that regard. And you just kind of, it's like a lot of people just really starting to drink themselves into waiting to die, really. I mean, I don't want to put it down 100%.
Yeah, do you work on the tourism board?
It sounds really appealing. It's the capital. Come on down. But it's just, I mean, there's, I think a lot of those smaller towns have that same vibe where it's, you either get, because there's such boredom and there's not much upward momentum, you either get people who kind of fold into that, or you get a lot of these very progressive, very free thinkers. And there was a lot of that. I mean, that's I got a lot of support when I was starting comedy there. I did a show at a coffee shop and that's how I made money for a couple of years. It's just getting donations for like 20, 30 bucks and then buying food for that with that and just doing these shows in empty rooms, 5 or 6 people just, and then they would always just let me come back and do it again the next month, you know? So there was a lot of support in that regard. And then just a lot of people who were trying to do pills, and that was it, you know?
Yeah.
Was that coffee shop like an official open mic, or was it sort of just like...
It was like a showcase that mm-hmm. I ran, and so, which mostly was open mic. We were mm-hmm. all open mic level, but it would just be me booking 5 or 6 people from like Portland or whatever, and that really, in the early days, let me see how much of an effort and how much of a grind you had to put into doing stand-up, because you'd get people who would just be like, no, I don't want to drive 40 minutes to come do your show because I could do shows here. And I was just like, man, this whole job is going town to town to town,
yeah,
trying to ply your trade. Why would you balk about a 40-minute drive?
Right.
You know, it's like, I live here. Like, every time I go do a gig, at one point I was on the Oregon coast. I was driving 2.5 hours to go do open mics. Man. It was like, it was ridiculous, but I mean, I just knew that that's how you had to do it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you did have a drive.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
I did. Thank you.
Yo, I want to, like, hit up all the jobs that, like, you know, were not thrilled with you and just be like, see?
Yeah, I mean, I just had to care, really. Yeah. I just didn't care about those other jobs. I hated them. I didn't want to be there. It was the only thing I was willing to start at the bottom at. I was like, man, I'll show up to work if I'm, like, the head of the company.
Yeah. And so you had those nights where it was just, like, it did not go great and still had to, like, drive all the way home, and that's a long, solitary.
Yeah.
Situation.
Yeah,
man,
it was horrible. A lot of times, even sometimes when it did go well, you're just like, what am I doing this for? Or you didn't get paid, or sometimes, you know, you're doing small podunk towns in the Northwest, some people, they're like performing in front of these crowds that are kind of racist and stuff. And I just remember I was doing a bit, and then within 3 minutes, she asked me some joke, was heckling me about whether I wanted to eat watermelon and if I knew Oprah. And I was just like, I don't even understand your racism. It's like such a weird racism. And I was just, and then I would get off stage and just be like, this is what I work hard for, to try to entertain people like this, you know? And it was very disheartening, but
yeah.
You know.
Well, follow-up question. Did you know Oprah?
Not at the time.
Yeah.
And not currently.
Yeah.
But hopefully in the future, I will know
Speaking
Oprah.
Speaking into existence.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing.
Yeah.
And what was the scene like up there? Did you find other people who had a similar drive as you?
Not at first. I mean, but it was a cool scene. It was a wild scene. And I think it was perfect for me at the time, because it was kind of coming into its own at the same time that I was coming into comedy. It was dire when I first started. It was just the only way to do any success, or to be successful, excuse me, was to do triple runs, which were these gigs where you're driving to like Billings, Montana, and all these other podunk towns, and you were just lucky if you broke even with the money. And I just knew I didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
And then there was like a group of other people who didn't want to do that, and we'd all just hit open mics and just go around town in Portland just hitting these different mics, and with no real roadmap of how this would even work out. But I think that was the best for us because you weren't, you didn't have anyone to copy to be like, this is how I be successful. You know, you just were like, oh, this is what I do. This is what I like doing. Nothing's going to come out of it.
Right.
So I might as well just be me and have fun. And I think that was like the best thing for me. And then we end up getting festivals. And now it's like a hotbed. Like a lot of comics travel through there all the time.
So who's the first person in the Northwest to take notice of you and be like, yo, I think that you're really good and there's more to it than just like Billings, Montana? Where, by the way, I bet there are cowboys out there, right?
Yeah, definitely. I had a couple headliners take me out that were like shitty regional guys that would be like, let's do these sets and now wait for me while I try to have sex with this waitress. And we just be waiting for hours. Damn. He would get it.
Dope. Thanks to support from people like you.
Yeah, he would get it. And that was horrible. So, and because I was also married at the time. So for a while, it was just me being like, oh, is this what comedy is? Like, you have to be a shitty dude and you just bilking bars out of, who don't even want comedy shows out of $50. And then I worked with this guy named Dwight Slade, who was a big comic in Oregon and was known for mostly hanging out and being best buds with Bill Hicks in the past. And he was like the first guy to teach me that you can be like a good guy and do comedy. Like, we would go out and go to zoos or a monastery and we would find fun things to do before the shows. And I would just be like, oh, okay, this can be fun. I can do it how I like to do it. And then one of the first people outside who saw me at the festival and then started taking me around was Moshe Kasher.
Mm-hmm.
He was just liked my comedy and liked me as a person. He's been a friend for a long time. And him. And then eventually it was like John Mulaney and Nick Kroll and stuff like that. So just cool. Sklar Brothers.
Yeah.
A lot of cool people.
What was the strangest festival experience that you ever had?
My strangest festival experience was this festival in Miami, in which it was a music festival with Modest Yahoo and a couple other people, and then he canceled, which should have been my first indication that this wasn't going to work out well. And then you get there, and it's like damn near a hurricane going on, and we're all doing comedy in these tents, and there's just like just wind being whipped up through these tents for it, and then they just didn't pay us. They paid us, but the checks bounced, and it was like the first time that had happened to me, where I was just like, oh, I'm never going to get this money.
Yeah.
It just isn't. I come out in the negative because I got to pay these bank fees now, you know? That probably was the weirdest festival I've been to. Most festivals are pretty chill, just boring as shit, you know? Just watching people drink all day.
Hannibal invited us to a festival. This is years ago. A festival that he was doing in
New Jersey.
Yeah, in the Giants Stadium parking lot.
Okay, this already sounds wonderful.
Oh, it was great. Yeah. And it was like, I don't know what kind of like,
it was Bamboozle Fest.
Yeah. And there were like, it was like Fallout Boy.
Off of the movie?
Yeah. It was real cerebral.
Yeah.
And it was dark.
Directed by
Spike
Lee.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it was like, it was super windy. We found out that comedy outside, usually a great idea.
No, it's not the best
idea.
You
had someone over there who was just like, midget wrestling happening in like 30 minutes. And Hannibal's just trying, you know, to get his stories across. Yeah. And it's
Machine Gun Kelly was performing over there. And Lil Wayne. And
No, festivals are like the absolute worst. It's just babysitting drunk people while they get ready to go see who they actually want to see. And it just doesn't work well for comedy. You do it because they pay well, you know. But I've never have, I mean, unless it's like a complete comedy festival, I've never been to like a music festival and been like, oh, it's cool. It brings out the worst in human nature, you know. It's the only place you go to and you will be like, oh, there's just a dude just pissing, like, he's just pissing right in front of me, and it's just the worst people.
And that's Lil Wayne.
So you're touring around with different guys, and do you get management at a certain point?
Yeah. When I first auditioned for like the Montreal Comedy Festival, my manager saw me at that time, and we just started talking a little bit. And, you know, she was just like, if you start if you have anything I can help you with, let me know, which usually means just like, hey, bust your ass, do something, and then I'll want you. And so I did, and then, yeah, she's been my manager ever since. So
wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we've cycled through, like, a few managers, and it's sort of like you try to figure, like, what they want out of it and how much they can do for you mm-hmm. as opposed to, like, what you can do for yourself.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it, like, you know, ever sort of equals out, but it is nice of them to offer.
No, I mean, I've been lucky in that regard.
Yeah.
Because I know a lot of friends who have to switch managers, and it can be, you know, it's like breaking up in a relationship.
Yeah.
I've had to switch agents.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, my manager just, I mean, has always shown the utmost belief in me, paid my rent when I couldn't pay
wow.
my rent, and, you know, just always, I mean, I'm buying a house right now, and, like, she legitimately
has a room
handled 90% of the all of that, like,
yeah.
got me the realtor, it handled, signed most of the things. I'm pretty sure that's illegal. But, like, she cares about me, cares about my life, and, like will not will stop me from, like, I want, there's a couple times I wanted to do these commercials, one where I would have been dressed up as a cockroach while being extra black.
Oh my god.
and she was just like, yeah, I know you need the money now, but that will you know, that'll be around, and you might not need that money 2 years from now.
Mm, right.
And, you know, and she
and
was
those
right.
commercials live forever.
Exactly. So she's always just been good at helping me see the whole picture.
That's awesome.
And at the same time, really advocating that I get the most money as possible. So I don't see me, unless things get weird, you never know. Hopefully we'll stick together.
And so at this time you're still living in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And did you see, even if you're traveling around the country, did you see a way for you to relocate to either New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, somewhere where it's a bigger sort of scene and more opportunities
for
you?
Not at the time, because, again, I was married, I had my son, and I knew, like, unless I had a job and some money, I wasn't going to be able to afford to go live in either one of those places. It's too expensive. So it really took, you know, until I got divorced to where I was like, oh, I just need another place to live.
Yeah.
So I found a place. I found just a room to rent out in Los Angeles, and I just started hustling and grinding, and then got my own place, and then now my son lives back with me, and it was just me and him, and now it's real cool.
Yeah, what was Los Angeles like when you first got there?
It was terrifying.
Yeah.
It was terrifying.
What is it like now? It's still terrifying?
It's more. It's still scary, but not terrifying, because I get it now.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, okay, you just got to drive like you're in the Wild Wild West. You got to be very offensive,
mm-hmm.
cut people off.
Right. Watch out for the packs of Hasidic Jews walking the streets.
That's right.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
You can drive through a red light up to two cars.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are the rules. You just got to learn the rules. And now that I know the rules, I like it a lot more. It's just, I love the fakeness of it, as well as, like, the drive. People have all this drive and delusion.
Mm-hmm.
That's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah.
I love the delusion of it, because sometimes you make it work, you
mm-hmm.
know? And again, that's like the opposite of where I came from, where there was just like, there's no hope, no desire. Out in LA, you just meet a guy and he's just like, I'm writing a script and I'm doing a thing. I'm just like, well, I'm like, cool. I don't know if that's going to work out for you, but more power to
yeah.
you. I'd rather have you doing that. I've always felt that, like, you can be as delusional as you want to be, as long as your effort outpaces that delusion.
Mm. Yeah.
When you're, like, delusional and lazy, then it doesn't make any damn sense.
Right,
you
right,
know?
Right.
But you can be as insane as you want, as long as you work hard.
What was your first Hollywood party like?
First Hollywood party. The first one I remember was, and the only one that I still go to, Sarah Silverman. She throws great parties, and it was just cool to go in there, and then there'd just be like containers of joints and edibles and just hanging out. And then, oh, there's Larry David. You're just like, whoa, this is real cool.
Yeah.
And those are the only fun ones I go to. I've been invited to some parties at different bars, but, like, I don't drink, so it's never been that fun for me. And then everybody looks like vampires and Jamie Foxx is there.
Yeah. So when you show up to like Sarah Silverman's party, are you Chuck E. Cheese Ron or are you Cashier Ron?
I'm in the middle. I talk to my friends.
Yeah.
luckily, you know, through stand-up, and it's cooler because, like, people can just see your act and see your and be like, oh, cool. I know you.
Yeah.
I know you. I like you. I love your act, and that's all I need to know.
Which means, by the way, you can't share those same anecdotes that you shared on stage with, like, Larry David, right? Like,
I don't even try to directly talk or look him in the eye. I try to avoid. But, you know, I'll introduce myself, say hello. It's always cool when people come up to me and know who I am, especially. Like, that's probably, like, the thing that keeps me going the most, because half the time, you know, especially now coming off of some sitcoms and stuff, people come see me, my work, and they don't necessarily know my style. Mm-hmm. And half the time I'm walking, like, you know, 6 to 10 people, and they just don't get what I'm about. But so it was nice to, like, have people who I've looked up to, like, I have, like, people like Wanda Sykes or Kevin Nealon or even like Howie Mandel, people who I grew up watching what they do, who come up to me and are like, you're something, like, you might not be ready yet, you might not be fully developed, but I see what you have in you, and that's the things that really keep me going.
That's
when
amazing.
I have half empty shows.
So you say you go out there and you start grinding, you start hustling, like, are you doing clubs, are you like waiting outside of clubs? How does that work? Like,
mostly the time I'm doing like Meltdown, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm doing comic book stores, I'm doing a lot of shows at empty bars, I'm doing just shows in the back of just anywhere, really, back of taco shops, whatever. I'm just doing a lot of that, and then auditioning for clubs.
Yeah,
you know, you have to break in and get into their rotation, and so eventually, you know, I had to get on that NBC show for like the Comedy Store and stuff.
Yeah.
To be interested in me, and now I go there and just eat shit at like 11 and at night when people were like, oh cool, it's Joe Rogan, oh cool, it's Theo Von, and then they're like, I don't know what the fuck this nigga's talking about.
So in New York, you can go to like do 5 different, like, you know, venues in one night, because you can just jump on the subway and like hit each one. You're driving out in LA and everything's not necessarily right around the corner. How do you, like, how many gigs can you do in a night, and is it a lot to sort of commit to make those drives?
Yeah, I mean, it's easier now because I have the club support, and now they'll, like, just email me asking when I want to come up. So mm-hmm. I just try to, like, stagger them where you're like, oh, I'll do the Improv and the Comedy Store and maybe, like, some independent room. I just try to usually hit, like, 5 or 6 a week. Which I know is not the same out here. It's like you can do 5 or 6 a night.
Right.
But then you just balance it, because out here, you're not really doing the, like, acting classes, auditions. I mean, so a lot of people are, but it's not as much as you are in L.A. And so I think that's the difference. In L.A., you do a lot of work in the daytime. You know, you're doing a lot of podcasting, you're doing a lot of auditioning, and a lot of ways, that's what the stand-up is out there, is right. You're auditioning for other projects at night, hoping people will see your work, you know. And that's the thing that really freaks me out when I go to my acting class and there are people being like, oh, my manager told me I need to get in the stand up so I could be seen. And I'm just like, that is so fucking weird that you would be told to do stand up so that you could be better in this career. Like, no, that's 10 years of struggling. Why would you want to do that?
When you're new to LA, who are the comics you're running around with?
Mostly the people who kind of took me in and showed me around were like Kamel and Emily. They've always been real supportive with me and kind of like, I guess, just like elder statesmen to me. I always kind of look at what they're doing and see what I want to do, you know, whether they were the first people who I knew who were like buying a house and things like that. And so I'm like, oh, cool. You open my eyes up to a new perspective and things that are possible, especially like with the Saturday Night Live type of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then again, Moshe, Nick Kroll, especially, you know, he gave me my first job working on the Kroll show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was that like?
It was terrifying. It was terrifying and cool because I had never written sketches. I've written some things for myself, but I didn't have final draft. I didn't know how to do anything like that. And
did you submit or did
no?
You?
The fact they were just, I just opened for Mulaney and then I'd open for Nick Kroll, and they were just, and I helped when I first moved. I helped John Daly. He was shooting some videos, and I just went to go help him. I played a small part in it, and then I just stuck around and would just pitch him jokes, and he was just like, "Oh!" Then he ends up being like the head writer of Kroll Show, and so in their second season, I was one of the people they reached out to because he was like, "Oh, I know you're funny. I know you know how to pitch jokes. We're interested in you." And Comedy Central was like, "No, he hasn't had any experience."
Right.
And then they just fought for me, and they got me the job. That's and so then dope. They found out that he probably wasn't good at it because I wasn't the best at it. I would hide in the bathroom a lot. I treated it like a regular job. I hide in the bathroom. I just wasn't, and I'm still not the best at writing in other people's voices. Mine is very specific. Like, my jokes in other people's hands don't tend to work that well. And
but you got to actually like be on. You did your own stuff like on.
Yeah, yeah. That's really how they helped me out. Was that instead of and I wrote some great things, but and it was really with the help of other people like me and Gabe Liebman. We wrote a lot of things for like the Cesar character, the Dad Academy. I think that's probably one of the things I'm most proud of. Was like that was the first time where I wrote a full sketch out with someone and then watched them perform it. And
yeah.
It was awesome. And then, yeah, like the lawyer stuff was just them being like, write yourself a sketch. If you're having such a fucking power time, write a sketch for yourself. And I did, and they liked it. And a lot of that lawyer character really just came out of how I was feeling working there. I was I was just like, oh, I'm happy. I'm nice. I'm happy to be here, but I'm overwhelmed. Right. And I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And that was that character. It was just a guy who was happy but did not know what he was doing. Because, I mean, you look at the cast of that show, and it's just really like a who's who of young Hollywood. And so I just feel blessed to be that I was a part of it.
What are some sketches or ideas that you pitched that just like never made it?
I pitched a lot of sketches that were black. And they were like, we don't have black cast members. I was like, yeah, it's me. Let me do it. I had a lot of sketches about the Black Mafia family at the time. You guys think you guys might be familiar, right? Are you familiar with the Black Mafia family?
BMF?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I was really into that at the time. And I just remember watching a video where they were like talking about how they were like, because clearly there was this drug empire masquerading as a music industry with artist.
Yeah.
But there's always this video that I think it had Big Meech in there, and he was talking about like Black Mafia takes off. You're gonna see us everywhere. Black Mafia movies, TV shows, plays. And I was just like, that is so ridiculous. So I just wanted to write a Black Mafia musical.
Yeah.
And so that was my idea for a while. I mean, a lot of stuff I just end up writing into like the Cesar character.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any strong feelings about Gold Rush?
I'm not familiar. What is Gold Rush?
They parodied it on the show. It was that show that took place.
Yeah, they were miners up in Atlanta.
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't. I didn't have anything to do with that.
like a black Gold Rush.
But right.
Yeah, I remember Joe Mandy hitting us up a number of times about like Riff Raff and World Star, and I just think it was cool that the writer's room was so tapped into hip-hop at that time.
Or hip-hop adjacent.
Right.
Yeah. No, I was always fascinated with Riff Raff. Myself, he seems, I mean, still not as much now, not that he's like a full Trump supporter. I haven't been as interested in him.
You know, he's like a bodybuilder now. But now he's like a fat bodybuilder.
Yeah.
Like, we saw him at ComplexCon like 2 weeks ago. Like,
walked by.
But he's like,
oh, right. MTV tattoo. Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I'm on an airplane once, me and Brent from the show I was on. And we were just walked by, and we were just like, one of us walks by and he just goes, Mr. Riff. And then I walk by and I go, Mr. Raff. and he was not amused. We thought it was hilarious.
Was he wearing sunglasses on the plane?
He was.
Oh, man.
Yeah. He was full Riff Raff.
You got to commit, right?
Yeah.
After Kroll Show, what happens next?
At the Kroll Show, I'm acting on like a puppet show for Disney XD, which was real fun. I got to learn a lot about character acting. Danny Woodburn, who played Mickey on Seinfeld, he was like kind of like the guy I worked with the most, and he just taught me a lot about just what it meant to be a character actor and just being professional on set. And That was kind of it. I was just kind of bouncing back and forth between writing in that, acting in that. Until
are you professional on set now?
Like, yeah. I mean, yeah, I am. I am very professional on set. I like to say I show up early. That's how I always feel. Like, the more you know and the more experienced you are, you can take more leeway. But I was like, I don't know shit. I better be on time and I better be nice.
Not hide in the bathroom.
Yeah, yeah. And I just found out I was better. I mean, I was kind of looking at the two different paths of whether I was going to go into mostly writing or go into acting, and I was just better at acting, and they treated you better, and they bought your lunches instead of me having to pay for my own lunch. So I was like, man, acting seems like the way to go. But it's cool now because it's like I can act and I can also punch up scripts and write for myself, and that's what I'm the best at, is when they let me have a little ownership of the character and do what I want to do.
In your career, how much do people in Los Angeles, not necessarily like your close friends, but people like, you know, you'll meet a couple times, how much do they think that they know what's best for you?
In what regard?
Like, they're like, you know what you should do? You're really good at this and you should do more of this. And you're like, you've met me twice and no, I don't want to.
Yeah, sometimes. It doesn't really come up because I don't talk to that many people. I keep my circle very small. I have like the same friends, like the guy who's opening for me here in New York, I've known since I started comedy. Mm. Like, and I mostly, that's my whole crew, is I have two or three people who I started comedy with that still do it, and we just work together, and I can count on them to give me their honest opinion. And a lot of them, they get it. They get me. Like, when I was like, it's the same people who, when I said I wanted to do comedy, were like, oh, okay, I see that.
Yeah.
A lot of people were just like, you, no way, you're too quiet. But like my mom and stuff, she was like, yeah, that makes sense for you.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. Like when I was like, oh, I'm going to go to wrestling school. People were like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Is there something special about going to either Chicago or to Salem or surrounding areas now, as opposed to when you were living in each of those places?
Yeah, it is. Probably more so Oregon now, because my mom left Chicago, and so I don't, like, I have my uncles and my cousins that come out sometimes, but when I go to Oregon, it's like I get like my high school friends.
Yeah.
I get a lot of people who show up, and it's just cool to get that support and just get that love, really. It's real nice, and it's cool to see that I look a lot younger than them.
Do you do like the flyer that says like Ron Funches, like homecoming, like,
yeah. No, I mean, because like I've never even been like that. I've never been the type of guy who's like, I'm going to hold down my city. You know? Yeah. It's probably because I moved around too much, you know?
Right.
So I've always just been like, home is wherever I'm at, you know? Like, I mean,
that's
I love
so deep.
Yeah.
It sounds like a real piece of shit. But, you know, I mean, I love all Chicago sports teams. Like, mm-hmm. If you were like, they'd be like, hey, who do you represent? Like, I'm always like in the Bulls, Bears, those are my teams. But, like, as far as like, oh, I miss Chicago, or I want to go live in Oregon and LA sucks. Like, I've never been that type of guy. Right. I'm happy to be wherever I'm at.
So, how do you get into Mulaney's show?
On his actual show?
Yeah, on his actual show.
Well, I mean,
obviously you toured around with
him. Yeah, I toured around with him and hung out with him, and it was real cool. I think he got his wife, his girlfriend at the time, I think she had just seen some of my videos, and she introduced me to him, and he just was like, I like your stuff. And he was the first person that brought me to New York, and I always thought that was a big deal. He's kind of became the way that I do business is a direct result of how he treated me, like just bringing me out. He put me up, he would pay me over what the club was paying me, and I was just like, this is in New York, I'm in Oregon, like you could get anybody in New York to do this, but you want me to come open for you? And it was a big deal for me. And so now, like, with my friends, I just try to, you know, take care of them, make
how
sure
how awesome is that.
Yeah, it's really decent.
Yeah, it's super decent. It's just a good business, man, good person.
Well, and tell us something shitty about him then.
He loves drama. He definitely loves talking shit, and that's real fun, because we would talk shit about, you know, national comedians and legends.
Yeah,
me and him just talking shit about Eddie Murphy, and then I'd be like, do you want to see this I just thinking he wouldn't give a shit, but I was like, oh, I want to show you this local Oregon comic that we're all making fun of. And he was just like, yes. So that's what I like about him. He's a little bitch. He's a drama-loving bitch.
Has Eddie ever showed up to Sarah Silverman's parties?
No. So we're safe. But I just ended up working on a show. I auditioned for it. I really wanted it at the time. I was like, man, this is would be a dream come true. Work with Mulaney, work with my friend. And end up giving that part to, I forget his name, but the drug dealer character
right.
mm-hmm. on there. And so then I just, you know, just ended up doing a guest spot, playing a toucan. Mm-hmm. And I just had a lot of fun. It was a fun time and a fun show to work on. I understand that it didn't come out well. But, like, to me, that's like everybody gets to mess up and gets to learn things, and the amount of respect that they showed for him by like airing out the full season mm-hmm. and never, and just how well he's doing now just shows yeah. you that, like, man, just keep plugging away. Clearly you're a genius.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And you know, I mean, he's only gotten bigger obviously with like Oh Hello, and mm-hmm. then like Radio City is like 6 or 7 or 8 nights like all sold out, which yeah. is incredible. It's
oh wonderful. Yeah, no, I mean, that's again where I go back and I'm like, oh, look at me, I made my bonus this week. And then I look over there and it's just like, okay, they just adding nights for you.
What was the experience like of going on it? They would shoot on like the like one of the lots, right?
Yeah, they shot on Fox.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did you get into like the whole like you ride your bike on the lot or like the golf cart or whatever that is, like that lifestyle?
No, I never really got into that. Mostly always into hanging out in my trailer, mm-hmm. just chilling out. I bring my PlayStation with me.
Nice.
And I would just hang out in there and try to avoid the snacks. Really. That's really the downfall. It's like so many goddamn snacks.
Tell us about first meeting Conan.
Okay, cool. Yeah. I mean, that was just like God, you know, mm-hmm. like for me, you know, Johnny Carson, all that stuff. Like, that's who Conan was to me growing up, watching him in the 90s, watching like Pimp Bot and all that other stuff. And I just always, that was the show I wanted to get on. And so I got on there and I met him, and like, he's just really nice and personable and just a great leader when it comes to like, now when I get to go sit on the couch and do interviews, he's just so sharp at like just leading you exactly where you need to go, where you just have to just follow along and hit the punchlines, and he makes you look like a million bucks. And just like the last time I went on, afterwards he just kind of leaned into me and he was just like, man, I just want to let you know you're one of my favorite guests now. And I was just like, this is not even a dream come true. Like, I couldn't even fathom this. And he's just cool because he's just like a guy that loves comedy above all, and I think that's what he sees in me as well. That I'm not in it for, like, I mean, I love money, but I'm not in it for money, and I'm not in it wasn't in it to chase girls. Mm-hmm. I was in the comedy because I like sketches, I like making jokes, I like playing, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's where we kind of meet eye to eye on that type of stuff.
So you're not the comedian who makes the guy who drives you to each gig wait for you while you're fucking some girl at the, at the
motel. No, I've never been. I'm still barely, I mean, I've had a couple one night stands, but it's rare. Also because, again, I don't drink, mm-hmm. so I really got a charm.
When you first got on Conan, is it something where you really look at that camera and you think that there's so many people watching beyond that camera, or are you just sort of in the moment and you're there and you just look at the audience?
I'm mostly just looking at the audience, to tell you the truth. I'm just really like, okay, cool, we made it here, we did it, now show them what we can do and just kill it. And that's always kind of my MO when I do anything like that, is to not just be happy that I'm there, be happy, but also just be like, I think, I don't remember whose advice it was, but they were just like, don't go up there being happy to be there. Go up there and think about all the people who told you you wouldn't be there, and then show them.
Yeah.
And that's how I just try to do it when I
do. Do you want to shout any of them out right here?
Shout out to my social studies teacher in high school, who, when I said I was being a comedian, you said, oh, but also, I mean, what are you doing for money? God. Fuck you. Shout out to my ex-wife. Mm. Shout out to her mom.
Who are some of the people in music who have reached out to you and said that they respect your work?
I mean, all of them are cool, but like, I think the coolest was like when I got Bun B to do the intro for my album. Mm-hmm. It was just because he was like a fan of Undateable. And I was just like, that is the funniest thing in the world to me. That'd be like just this Southern rap legend, drug dealing legend, mm-hmm. all around gangster, mm-hmm. who's just like, oh man, I just like watching that sitcom. Yeah, I'll do your intro. And it was just real cool. Didn't ask for any money, didn't ask for anything. And it was just super cool. I mean, Devin the Dude is cool as fuck. Mostly like younger rappers, like Mikey Christmas out of Boston. Mm-hmm. I fucked with him a lot. I think I'm going to be in one of his music videos coming up.
That's awesome. Yeah.
And I mean, it just now also, like, I do these like treadmill jams of the day with rappers that I like or just music that I like. And then a lot of them end up writing me back and being like, oh, actually, this helps people come look at my shit when you do this. So
Has Big Crit reached out?
No, not Big Crit. I wish he did. I didn't, because people were like, you guys look alike. And I didn't see it. But then I was like, I see it. I wanted to be mad. But actually, that's a compliment. So I'll take it. That's the handsome dude.
You're lucky, by the way, because so we've had meetings with like Lior Cohen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like an hour and a half meeting, like a substantial meeting. And the first one was when he was at 300, his label. And we sat down, and in the middle of it, like 45 minutes in, he's like, you know who you remind me of? And we're just like, you know,
I don't know.
Any Jew, right?
Yeah.
And he's like, Harpo Marx. And we're like, Harpo Marx? And he's just like, yeah, I don't know, something about you. And it's like,
I see it.
Oh,
but it's like the one who does the like doesn't even like talk. Yeah,
it's in your cheese. Yeah.
But we went to a second meeting with him, and we know him very well, and we sit down in this meeting, and like 5 minutes in, he's like, you know who you look like? And we're like, Harpo Marx? And he's like, someone's told you that before? We're like, yeah, you. So, you know, Big Crit's not so bad.
Like, no, and it's been changing a lot, because it used to be when I was heavier, it was always like Wesley Willis or Bruce. And then lately it's just been like, you look like Big Crit, or you look like The Weeknd. And I'm like, this is a lot better.
Take that. Are you kidding?
Yeah. You should go somewhere and tell people that you're The Weeknd and get in there.
Yeah, you should tell Michael Christmas that you're The Weeknd. Yeah.
We get a track.
When you were growing up, what kind of music were you listening to?
I listened to a little bit of everything. I grew up on my mom's music, of course. So it was a lot of like 60s soul music. Mm-hmm. But again, a lot of R&B, a lot of and then just a lot of rap music. You know, my first tape that I purchased, and it was a tape, was the Fugees, The Score.
Yeah.
And I was into that, and then Too Short. And then Devin the Dude was, when I was 13, really kind of like
inspired you to start smoking.
Yeah, I mean, it still took me a few more years, but it really, really informed the way I look at life and humor and jokes, because he was very funny. He was very much an everyman. He wasn't talking about shooting people and stuff. He was just talking about like, oh, I just want to smoke weed and hang out with ladies, and sometimes bad things happen to me, and that's what I rap about, and that's kind of like what I do with my comedy. Mm-hmm. Is the same type of vibe off of that. I'm a bit like, a lot of my influences come from either rap or pro wrestling, and so, like, I would say my biggest influences on my comedy directly from rap would be Devin the Dude and Currency.
Yeah.
Because I just always like how Currency, again, very chill, very down to earth. Never the thing where you're like, oh, he's a punk. You know, he's clearly like a down solid dude.
Mm-hmm.
But he's just like, oh, and also I'll tell you about the shows I'm watching. I'll do a reference to like the second season of The Real World and things like that. And that's kind of like how I do with my humor now, where I'll be like, talk about Wishbone or talk about just these things I grew up loving. Because I think if I can get you on the base joke, it's dope. But then if you also get my references, and then we have a deeper connection, because then you're like, oh, I know what this dude watches. I know what he's about. And I do the same thing. And that's what I fell in love with Currency's music. And that's what I try to emulate.
What is your acting schedule like now? Like, what's the ratio between auditions and actually like shooting these days?
You know, it's getting better. I'm doing getting some things where I get offered some things, and that's awesome.
Yeah.
Mostly I'm doing a lot of little guest spots on different shows, different pilots or whatever. I was on Curb Your Enthusiasm last
week. Saw that.
And then I did.
What was that like?
Oh, that was amazing.
Did you look Larry David in the eyes?
I did that time. I did. And I just, mostly I just scoped him like a hawk and just watched whatever he did, try to figure out his style, his secret sauce. And
yeah, like how many takes are you doing of?
Not that many, like 3 or 4, and it's really just them going like, Larry needs this information from you. You don't want to give it to him, but eventually you give it to him, and that's it.
And then they cut the part where you actually give him the information, right?
Yeah. They cut that out and then put it into the deleted scenes, I think. So I was just upset. But
don't worry, everybody out there is still buying DVDs. Like, we're all good. Yeah.
But it was just, again, it was cool to be a part of it. I was working on another show at the time, and they were threatening to not let me go. And I was like, really? I will quit.
Yeah.
I will quit for this one line.
one that you were acting on or one that you were writing?
Yeah, I was acting on it. Yeah. It's a show called Powerless on NBC. And they were just like, we might need you. Because whenever you're working there, they just were like, no, don't mess with our schedule, even though they don't need you. Yeah. Like, I'm looking at the script going like, no, I'm not in this scene. I'm not in this scene. It should be fine. And they're just like, oh, we don't know. We might need you. So you can't do it. And then, but, you know, we just strong-armed them.
How does it feel to be back at NBC after having been there, you know, 2013 or whatever?
I mean, it's cool. It's just nice to go to a place and actually know people. Mostly anything that I've shot has been at Warner Brothers studio, and so it's kind of cool to like walk in and have security guards know who you are, and people be nice to you, because a lot of times you're just like, especially with me, they were just like, what are you here? What are you doing here? And then they just be like, are you a grip? No, I'm acting.
Are you the Weeknd?
Yeah, I know, yeah.
You can start a whole new life.
Yeah.
Really like Don Draper it.
But I mean, it's just cool because, I mean, you know, executive wise and stuff, I don't really know people, but it's like the ground floor people, the people who do press and stuff, like, it's always cool when they see me and they're like, oh, great. I'm glad that you're still working. I'm glad that you have a job because you're a nice dude and you're good at this job. And that's, I mean, that's all I ever want to hear is shit like that.
Totally.
So, I mean, right now I'm just kind of working on my own projects and trying to pitch things. We're going to pitch things around at the end of the month. I'm working with Seth Rogen on project, and
that's awesome.
Yeah, I'm excited about it.
Well, so. Now I'm excited about
it.
Yeah. So you've worked obviously on a lot of like voice acting roles. Bob's Burgers, I know everybody, they like to do it when everybody's like around each other. Do you like that more, or do you like doing it sort of like in the solo vocal booth more?
To be honest, I mean, the energy of when you're doing it together is awesome, because you can improvise more, and you can you just don't have to put as much imagination into it. You just kind of live it. But I think I work a little better solo, just because I'm more free when I don't look over and think I have someone looking at me, you know. I think that's when I do my best work, is because I can just really get weird and wild and do as many takes as I like. Both are fine, but like, I just think it's easier to do it solo and more definitely more time effective. I don't have to sit there the whole time and do my two lines.
What was it like dancing in front of, I imagine in front of, Justin Timberlake for Can't Stop the Feeling? Yeah, by the way, this morning I was watching the video, and, you know, I'm like blasting it in the apartment, and Eric is like just having a Justin Timberlake sort of morning, and I'm like, no, I'm like, you know, doing research, Ron was in the video. Yeah.
Either way, it's a hit.
Yes.
You should be playing it. It was a jam of the summer. I loved it so much every time I heard it. It was cool. The video was cool. I didn't really. He wasn't there for that. It was just me in an arcade, because they were just like, "Where are you? Where would you want to be?" And I was like, "This is where I hang out." So we just did it in an arcade. But I did have to sing on it, do some backgrounds on it for the movie version, and that, like, he was there and he was directing me, and that was crazy and that was intense to be like, okay, because I just thought I could play around and just be like, you know, I can't sing, so I'll just do some funny stuff. And then he was just like, "No, I'm gonna need you to do it exactly like this." She's like, yes, sir. And it was just cool. He was real down to earth, real nice person, and real fucking passionate about what he did. And it was cool to see someone who cares as much about a different art form as much as I care about comedy, and just be like, oh, it's clear why you're successful. Yeah. This is what you're about. And it was just, I mean, again, I'd never thought I'd ever be in like a booth in Justin Timberlake's studio trying to sing a song, and then my mom met him and tried to sexually assault him. It's a cool life.
Have you seen Justin since?
Just at the movie premiere. Mm-hmm. I just saw him at the premiere where my mom attacked him, and he got very scared. And I came up because he was looking for security, and then I was like, no, Justin, this is my mom. And he was, then he hugged her and was nice to her. He's a nice guy. He's a very nice guy.
Mm-hmm. You were on our friend's show, Desus and Mero.
Mm-hmm.
How did you go about choosing your rainbow?
I just did it at the time because I had no idea about it. I hadn't seen the show at the time. I just knew them from like random podcast work and sketch mm-hmm. work and, you know, being the Bodega Boys and whatnot. But I had never been on their show, and I didn't know. I mean, that was one of the biggest deals I'd been on, because, man, they are very, very popular.
Yeah, yeah, no kidding.
Very, very nice guys. Mm-hmm. I could say like they're their new Wayne's World, basically. Mm-hmm. Black Wayne's World. Mm-hmm. And just...
Wait, was Black Wayne's World another idea that you had for Kroll Show?
Yeah, 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 they didn't like it. But I just knew how big of a deal it was, because the next day I was in Philadelphia doing a show, and a guy saw me and he was all like, you're on Desus and Mero.
And you're like, no, that was Big Crit. Like,
he's like, here's a free whoopie pie. And I was like, what? Free whoopie pie? This is the best show ever. But it was just real cool and real funny, and they were real, low-key about everything, and probably one of the best interviews I had. Like, I mean, I got a lot of great feedback off of it, so it was cool as fuck.
What was your rainbow?
I think it was... be nice. Get your money. I think it was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Also, good advice just to live by. You know.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's my. Yeah, be nice and get your money. You don't have to go get everyone's money, but go get yours. It's there for you. I've seen it out. I live in LA. I know it's there. Go get your money.
See, the longer explanation is an even better rainbow.
It's a bigger rainbow. Mm-hmm. It was too big.
Is it too late to go down to Miami and get your money? Like, literally?
It might be too late. But, you know, I've made more money since then. I'm okay with it. And I got to go to Miami. I got that story. I got to see some Cuban butts. It was awesome.
So now when you're touring around the country, how often do you revamp your set?
Right now I've been mostly trying to focus on honing an hour to try to sell. So if you've seen me in the last, since the summer till now, you've probably seen a lot of the same shit.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll just kind of dump it and move on. I'm not the most prolific writer. I'm not like Kyle Kinane or something like that, or Louis C.K. Thanks, God. Because we see what you have to do that. But like, I just try to live my life and whatever comes out of that, because I don't really do topical stuff. I don't do political material. I just do things that excite me, and so usually it's like whatever show I'm watching or what my son's doing, and so a lot of times that takes a little bit more time to actually live through it, have some life changes.
Mm-hmm.
I just bought a house, and my mom's getting ready to come live with me, and
that's,
I'm like,
awesome.
Okay, there'll be some material.
Yeah, super dope. That's the only reason to keep doing stuff.
Yeah, just for new material.
Yeah, pretty much.
You have one of the best laughs that I know of.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Which is better than, you know, when people criticize, like, you know, Elliot Wilson's laugh or our laugh on a podcast. Yeah. But I was wondering, can you do a fake laugh?
Ha! That's a fake laugh. That's like if you hear me at a club and one of my friends are bombing.
When you were doing early stand-up, did you have to sit through, like, bringer crowds? Like, that whole, like, where it's, like, 20 people are going to be going up there and you're, like, number 18 and you have to, like, wait through the first 17?
No, I didn't, because I wasn't in a big city, mm-hmm. you know? And so we didn't have that. It's not like L.A. and New York where you have that. It was just... more like surprise shows.
Yeah.
Like, we're at a bar and you just thought you came to drink with your friends, but guess what? There's a show now. Why are you mad? Oh, no, now shut up. Stop talking to your friends. We're going to do a show, and I'm not good yet.
Is there video of early you on YouTube?
I'm sure there is, yeah.
You have not, like, sat down and just done, like, a sort of, like, rabbit hole of your early work?
No, that sounds like a really quick way to get depressed. No, I don't look myself up. I don't understand when people, like, have Google alerts for themselves or things like that. Like, I just keep it moving, really. Yeah. Like, I'll go back and watch, like, the last things I did and critique myself. Like, I watched, like, The Curb, and I was like, oh, that was cool for the small amount that I did. And then I watched The Future Man that I did on Hulu, and I was like, oh, cool, your acting is, I just like to go and like, oh, okay, cool, you look like an actor as opposed to like just a comic reading lines,
right?
And so that's all I care about, is if I see some progress. But as far as like, I don't care what other people really think about my shit.
That's dope,
you know. Like, I don't really do it for that. I just do it for, I mean, I want people to like it.
Right.
But, like, I also just want me to like it. I want to do the comedy that I don't see a lot of the comedy that I want to see. So I like to do it.
Well, was there a turning point where you, like, stopped listening to what other people might critique you and say?
Yeah. Mostly when I moved to L.A. Before then, you know, I listen to a lot of podcasts. I listen to, like, any comedy podcast, that just so that you feel connected, feel a part of it, see what's going on. But then it's just, like, became too easy to hear other people's voices in my head. And then when I'd go to write, I could hear, like oh, you're writing a Pete Holmes joke, or you're writing a Mulaney joke. And so it just became like, oh, get rid of that. Don't listen to that. Now it's just all back to pro wrestling podcasts and video games. And just kind of do what you want to do. Because I think it might have been Patton who was just like saying, like, your first 10 years or so are you learning how to do comedy and constructing it, and then you kind of deconstruct yourself and then just become yourself. And I think that I'm at the beginning of that right now, where I'm like, oh, I know the rules, I know how to do setups, punchlines, callbacks, I know how to do all of that. And now I'm just learning how to be more me, be myself, talk about the things that I care about, and take more time and not necessarily be looking and needing laughter every 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Like, you know. So.
Anything else?
No, I was going to wait for 30 seconds and then laugh.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Congratulations on everything, really. Thank like you. Making it all the way from, I mean, Los Angeles back to Los Angeles. But now you have a house there with a backyard where you can do your backyard wrestling, right?
Yeah. Excited. We throw people in the pool, jumping off the balcony. It's crazy over there. You get sued for sure.
Thank you so much for coming through.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks everyone for listening to this new episode of A Waste of Time with It's The Real Jeff. If people want to find out more about you and me, you're Jeff, I'm Eric, we're It's The Real. If people want to find out more about this podcast, it's called A Waste of Time with It's The Real. If people want to find out what we're going to be up to in the next year, 2018, where can they go?
I don't know, ask a psychic. Go to itsthereal.com today. You can always find all of our updates on itsthereal.com, itsthereal. If you go to SoundCloud, you can listen to all of our old episodes at soundcloud.com/awasteoftime. You can also go to iTunes and search for A Waste of Time with It's The Real. Every single day I find out we're on a new streaming platform. Today I found out we were on YouTube and AudioMac.
Hey.
You can search for us on any streaming platform to listen to our podcast. It's worth a listen on any single one. If you want to listen to our music, that is also on all the DSPs, including Spotify, Google Play, Apple Music, Pandora,
Tidal,
all of them. Go search for Teddy Bear Fresh by It's The Real. Our album is doing very well on Spotify especially. You can always go find us on Instagram at It's The Real, Twitter at It's The Real, Facebook at It's The Real. I am on Snapchat. I don't really use it, but I have been getting ads. As in, people are adding me, not getting ads. I'm not being sponsored by people. But we are there. It's The Real. Also, we're on Twitch and we haven't used it yet. But if any nerds want to follow us, we are It's The Real. It's The Real on there.
And go to youtube.com/itsthereal and watch all of our content there. Jeff, this podcast does not grow unless the good people who listen to this podcast regularly tell a friend. And we love when you guys tell a friend, and we like to tell our friends to tell their friends. So, Jeff, which friend would you like to tell?
I want to tell Zeke Hirschberg, who just started his job at Alamo Music. He now has a cubicle outside of Todd Moskowitz's office, and congratulations to him on his new venture forward.
Jeff, I would like to shout out Shiva Singh 23, because Shiva went on iTunes and left a comment saying, was told to leave a review on multiple intros, so here I am. Great podcast. Only request is for y'all to go on Everyday Struggle. Guys, if you go and search Everyday Struggle with Kyle, we are on that episode. On the episode out in ComplexCon in Long Beach, California. It's a lot of fun. We tried our best to make him laugh. It sort of went left, but...
it went so left. It did not go well at all.
But go...
I feel terrible about it, to be honest.
But go back and watch it and let us know what you guys think. We so appreciate you guys tuning in week after week after week. As always, not for real, for real.
Sure, sure.
We'll see you guys next week.